This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
Clinical research in Europe is changing, due not only to the ongoing march of science, but in response to new legislative and regulatory developments. What's new? The Clinical Trial Data Transparency Framework, the Medical Device and In Vitro Diagnostic Regulations, the Clinical Trial Regulation, and the unknown impact of Brexit, for starters. Dr. Peter Schuller is Senior Vice President, Drug Development Services CNS for ICON PLC in Frankfurt, in Germany, where he was previously Senior Vice President for Medical and Safety Services. Through these and other experiences, Dr. Schuller has gained extensive knowledge about the challenges and opportunities for clinical research in Europe. I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of DIA Global Forum. Dr. Schuller will be a featured speaker at DIA's first Clinical and Regulatory Operational Excellence Forum in Europe. And he joins me today to discuss the current and future states of clinical and regulatory operations in Europe. Thank you for joining me today, Dr. Schuller, and welcome.
Thanks. My pleasure, Alberto.
What is most important about the link between clinical and regulatory operations in Europe at this time?
I would say at these days, as you rightly lined out, there are lots of changes in the regulation, so that itself is a challenge for anyone who is in the operational field, because whatever you're doing, you have to make sure you do the things right and the right things aligned with regulatory requirements. That's the one anyway happening. P's and regulations always change during a clinical trial, so that's why this is not the most stunning piece. I think the major change we observe right now is that the data volume is increasing and all people involved with clinical trials more or less become people with data mining, data observation, data integration, et cetera, responsibility. So getting the arms around the data in a way that the data speak for themselves and are still in line with the regulatory requirements, I think that is the challenge. And with more data coming in, this challenge is becoming a bigger hurdle.
Back in Glasgow at the recent DIA Euro meeting 2017, this past March, you chaired the Diamond Session on current trends and solutions in global clinical operations. Can you tell us what important messages came out of that session?
Yeah, in essence, it was around the same topic in terms of saying, what can we do in a way of better planning and better structured planning before we start a clinical trial, to make sure that we have, how our American colleagues always like to say, have all the ducks in a row. So that more structured upfront planning, I think that was a key message coming out of that. Not leave the design of the protocol, for instance, to the most junior people in the team. It should be a task of the most senior people in the group. And it should follow certain, in itself, milestones and structures. And I think what was the second key outcome of that session, that more and more involvement of patients will be required, so that we not artificially design clinical development programs in a very academic setting. And then it turns out that many aspects are not truly doable and are not really fully connected to clinical routine and practicality, but that this has to be, you know, addressed upfront in the planning process by getting all stakeholders involved. And we nowadays more involve, of course, clinicians, key opinion leaders, as we had done in the past, but we more and more also now involve patients to make sure what we design for a clinical development is not only fit for other stakeholders, but also for the key stakeholder, the patient.
Are you saying that that leaving the protocol design to more junior people, as you said, has had some unintended consequences?
It was a kind of common thing that copy and paste was a most used practice in designing clinical trial protocols in the past, and this is now no longer feasible. Clinical trial protocols are more and more based on evidence, and the evidence is growing based on the data we create. In other words, when a clinical trial was not super successful in the past, we really have to sit down and learn and digest the data, why that happened, what we could do better in the next round. And not just by gut feel, but really by evidence in terms of what sites, what countries, what investigators did contribute, did not contribute, what was the dropout rate, what was the screen fail rate, what selection criteria contributed to the screen fail rate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a long list of evidence we can create with our advanced data technologies nowadays, and we have to make use of that. And that can only be supervised and managed by senior people.
Are you saying that today it is a must to have a more thoughtful, more sophisticated approach to protocol design than maybe even 5 years ago?
Absolutely, because the resources are getting more and more tight. We are allowed to use in clinical development. The time is a more and more constraining factor on top of that. So we can only compensate for these two additional hurdles, having less resources and have to fulfill our tasks in a shorter time, by doing it more appropriately, simply saying, so that we not only apply what we anyway do in our industry, advanced technologies, but also do a better planning. And that's why I was saying better planning is crucial, and better planning includes making use of available information before you start with the first next step.
You mentioned involving patients in protocol design. How specifically can sponsors involve patients, practically speaking?
There are several avenues. The most common one is to involve the classical patient advocacy groups in the given indication you're targeting. That is what happens usually. A little kind of flip side there is that these organized patients are pretty professional in a way of understanding what it is, but also in terms of what their expectations are, how available they are, how interested they are in research, etc. So it's again an artificial setting in itself to a certain extent. And a way out is that there are wider user groups now with all the social media that have a certain interest in clinical research. Some of the patients already got organized in dedicated networks for patients only. So that's a more naturalistic environment where you can ask questions to a wider community as well. Not necessarily all those patients already having done a clinical trial. So you get more information. And then there is, of course, always the option, what is not yet becoming routine, that you actually do a dry run of your clinical trials. That would require a separate informed consent process for patients involved in that. But it would give you a pretty good idea how patients actually are willing to contribute to this exercise of a clinical trial, how well they could take a long list of assessments on the visit days, whether they can do it at all during a visit day. And it also gives you a kind of mutual input from the investigator side and the involved patients together in saying, is it doable? Is it practical? Is the flow or rate, etc. So what we do in all other industries, that we really do a dry run before we execute, we not do that in our industry. We just design it on paper. We artificially and kind of virtually think it through, but we don't really test it. And the test run is basically the time between final protocol and the First Amendment, what we typically see.
In this age of precision medicine that we've all entered, is it reasonable to expect that a patient advocacy group would be able to represent an entire patient population at a time when we're really focusing on individual patients, perhaps individual genomic profiles, and so on? Is there a tension there, or is there an inconsistency?
That's a very good question you ask, Alberto, because these precision medicines and personalized therapies have, of course, the major challenge in itself in saying, how do we then find these few patients, sometimes down to one patient only,
eligible
for a certain therapy? And how can we then get input from this one specific individual? Of course, what is tried at the moment is, and that's another option also to make kind of a front-loading effort of finding patients before they actually be part of a clinical trial, is to open registries for a certain genomic type, for a biomarker, so that patients get clustered together, get observed over a period of time, and when there is a clinical trial coming up, they can, if they wish, roll over from the registry into the trial, so that there is a kind of better understanding what is happening to these patients, what these patients prefer. It's less than a kind of focus group type of interview process with individuals. It's more an observational approach. But I think that's the way we have to do more when we come to the precision medicine aspect.
This coming September, you will be a speaker at the Clinical and Regulatory Operational Excellence Forum sponsored by DIA. What trends and corresponding potential solutions do you plan to highlight in your presentation there?
The whole meeting will be very much based on a kind of dialogue between regulatory and operational people. I think it will also already be visible at the opening lecture, because we plan to have two people, holding the opening lecture, one from the operational field, one from the regulatory excellence field, so that the kind of bridge between what do regulators expect and what can operational people deliver, and vice versa, is the expectation realistic and is it appropriate to not always reach these expectations from the regulator's perspective on the operational end. So that tension in between these and the kind of diverse expectations set in both groups, that should be sorted to a certain extent in this dialogue during the session, finding out where common ground is and what both parties can actually contribute to provide best quality data for best medicines to address unmet medical needs at the end.
Is there anything specific or particular to Europe in terms of clinical and regulatory operational excellence that would be different from, say, the realities in the US or in Asia?
Well, we currently have a widely scattered landscape in Europe, as we all know, with different regulatory expectations, but also with different operational challenges, east to west, north to south, very different, how standards of care are managed, how ethics committees are organized, how safety reporting goes, et cetera, et cetera. So there is not the unified Europe at the moment. We hope it will change with the new regulation, the European Clinical Trials Regulation, that will replace the directive so that we're not have to translate everything into local law, but it's directly active law as it comes from the European Commission. And that should address some of that. But at the moment, we still have a disadvantage compared to the US, for instance, where we have way less regulatory hurdles. We have one authority only, have a widespread marketplace, have very standardized care options, very standardized healthcare systems, etc., etc. So the diversity has, of course, a certain benefit because we can find an appropriate country for a certain type of disease and a certain type of medicine and a certain type of trial design. But finding that specific few countries that would best fit for a certain concept is a challenge of its own, and not all this works because the landscape is changing typically while we plan for something like that. And that should really get more harmonized, and there's high expectations that this will happen with the regulation coming in.
Let's talk about the EU clinical trial regulation, which will come into force, I guess, in 2018 or maybe 2019, depending on certain factors. What do you foresee as the biggest impact of this regulation on clinical operations and regulatory operations in Europe?
Yeah, there is big hope that we would need less resources for the startup of a clinical trial. At the moment, this is the most resource demanding aspect of getting the trial off the ground, getting all the approvals, getting all the documents shuffled around and filed appropriately with all the different languages, with all the different formats, with all the different timelines, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that is a high complex environment. I think there are not many industries where getting something started is as complicated as in clinical trials environment. And that's level of complexity should get reduced. Whether that would actually save time is a secondary question, but I'm very optimistic it will at least save costs and resources.
So it's intended to simplify the process and possibly accelerate it. It sounds like you are maybe a little bit on the fence in terms of the benefit that will accrue from the regulation. Is it too early to be optimistic about it?
Because it's a regulation and no longer a directive, I think the European Commission learned from the mistakes when they launched the previous directive, because the translation into local law was creating lots of diversity, and they take that complexity now out with the regulation. Of course, they still now have to find an upfront agreement with all the involved parties, and Europe is a pretty large community at the time as we speak. So that's why even, unfortunately, some people are leaving the union, but it's still many stakeholders in there. And that's why I think it will earliest be 2018 when they manage to get that rolled out. But once it's there, I'm truly optimistic it will take out complexity, because otherwise it would not be worth the effort, and the Commission knows that. So they know they have to defend the European marketplace as a market for doing appropriate clinical research, also in the interest, of course, of the patients, because patients can have easiest and earliest access to innovative medicines through clinical trials. And if Europe fails with offering that to their patients, we will have a massive drop in our ability to take care of, for instance, lots of cancer patients, many other unmet medical needs in CNS, where my field is. So it would be a really disaster for the patients if we would not reestablish Europe as a very attractive market for doing clinical research.
Remind us what might stand in the way of implementation of the regulation in 2018 and might cause a delay into 2019. What factors are at play here?
I think it's still under negotiation what the individual common ground and what the common denominator across all the stakeholders is at the moment. I think that's, from my insights, the biggest hurdle. Then, of course, coming next is the change of location for the European Medicines Agency, the EMA. They will leave UK after the Brexit. And the rumors are out there they may make announcement later this year when and where to leave. And of course, moving an organization like EMA from one country to another will create lots of loss of internal intelligence. Lots of people will leave EMA. They have to rehire, they have to retrain, and that will be a disruption in their process. And that may also delay the whole rollout.
You're already alluding to the potential impact of Brexit and the move of EMA on clinical and regulatory operations in Europe, and you sound a little bit worried. Is that fair to say? Do you see a way that the move of EMA and Brexit will have a minimal impact on clinical and regulatory operations in Europe?
I think the people at EMA in charge are smart enough to understand that they are at a big risk of creating lots of disruption and breaking certain processes, because, as said, moving a major organization like that is not trivial. So I think they put already lots of efforts in the planning process. And of course, they will have to put lots of efforts in the hiring process to get people on board and rather ensure a smooth as possible transition. But it will not be as smooth as if EMA would just continue to operate out of UK. So it will be a drop in performance over time during the moving process from one country to the other. And that's what we all have to expect. So I think everyone who has to submit a clinical trial application during this process or has to upgrade the Eurovigilance database or whatever, it will be delayed and it will not be as smooth as it had happened before. And unfortunately, now we see that EMA is working very professional nowadays. They had some hiccups and cracks at the beginning. And I'm afraid we will see something like what we saw in the first years after introduction of EMA, again, after the move of the EMA.
And we will all be watching developments very carefully, of course, in the coming months and years. That brings us to the end of our conversation. Dr. Schuller, thank you very much for joining us today, and thank you for your time and thoughts.
My pleasure, Walter, and good success further on with your developments. Bye-bye for now.
For DIA Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.